I think we in psychiatry are at a different stage than, for instance, the colleagues in oncology, which over the years have been quite good at developing tools that can identify patients that are more likely to respond to a certain intervention. I think we are on the brink of entering that phase in psychiatry right now as well. So the overall intention of doing what we are doing is, on one hand, to develop novel interventions, novel antidepressants, but do that together with selection tools that will select the patients that are more likely to respond to certain treatments so we can focus on them. And patients who are not so likely to respond should probably go for some other treatment. So it's about matching the patient with the intervention.
Welcome to the Future of Psychiatry podcast, where we explore novel technology and new innovations in mental health. I'm your host, Dr. Bassey, an addiction physician and biomedical engineer. Today, we are with Hans Eriksen, who is the Chief Medical Officer of HMNC Brain Health, and we're going to talk about the company's precision approach to psychiatry using predictive diagnostics. HMNC is a company that uses artificial intelligence and new genetic advances to create more effective and personalized treatment plans. Their focus is mainly on treatment-resistant depression and major depressive disorder. They are the first and only company with this approach in mental health care, providing patients with targeted, personalized therapies that are powered by predictive diagnostics. They developed a patented genetic test such as biomarker test ABCB1 already on the market, which facilitates the selection of the most suitable antidepressants for the patients. Welcome, Dr. Eriksen.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So this on paper sounds incredible. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you all are doing with precision psychiatry and what that means?
Yeah, I'm a clinical psychiatrist myself, and I've always been stunned by the approach that we generally apply in psychiatry. Then we have patients coming in with quite diverse symptomatologies, but they are still diagnosed as having, for instance, major depressive disorder. And then we don't have very much guidance about what treatments to use. I mean, there is an abundance of antidepressants out there and also other therapies for depression, but there is no real guidance. And typically, most clinicians start with a standard antidepressant if they select to go for the antidepressant route. And if that doesn't work, they go to the next drug. So it's sort of a trial and error approach in the treatment. And here I think we in psychiatry are at a different stage than, for instance, the colleagues in oncology, which over the years have been quite good at developing tools that can identify patients that are more likely to respond to a certain intervention. I think we are on the brink of entering that phase in psychiatry right now as well. So the overall intention of doing what we are doing is, on one hand, to develop novel interventions, novel antidepressants, but do that together with selection tools that will select the patients that are more likely to respond to certain treatments so we can focus on them. And patients who are not so likely to respond should probably go for some other treatment. So it's about matching the patient with the intervention.
Gotcha. And in terms of selecting or recommending the most appropriate antidepressants, are we there yet? Because that, to most psychiatrists, sounds like the holy grail is to ask the question, you know, what should my patient be on first?
I don't think we are there yet when it comes to the currently existing antidepressants. And I think when clinicians are making selections of antidepressants for their patients, it's probably more driven by the characteristic side effect profile of a compound. So let's say we have a patient who is agitated in the depression, a physician might select or prescribe a somewhat sedating antidepressant. But on the efficacy side, there is not so much we can go by. So it's more about going for the tried and trusted drugs that work most of the times, but not all of the times.
Tell me about biomarker test ABCB1. What does that tell us when we do it?
This is actually a test that is aiming at refining the dosing of the patient because it gives information about to what extent certain antidepressants are passing the blood-brain barrier. It will give a hint to the investigator or to the clinician, if we're not talking about clinical trials, that maybe the dose should be adjusted upwards or downwards. Because it's one thing to measure plasma concentrations of an antidepressant, but what is really important is the concentration in the brain. And we normally are not able to do that. But this test gives us an information about to what extent the antidepressant is likely to pass the blood-brain barrier.
Interesting. And in terms of the novel antidepressants that you're developing or your team is developing, tell me about what the mechanism of action is for those and why you decided to focus on that.
So our company's history goes back to decades of research in the field of stress-related depression. The human body has a mechanism for the brain to control the production of the stress hormone cortisol from the adrenals. So it's a series of hormonal signals starting in the hypothalamus, going down and eventually leading to cortisol production as a response to a stress. It has been known for quite some time that this delicate system is disturbed in many depressed individuals. So about a third of depressed individuals seem to have a hyperactivity in this system. So it's a sort of an overdrive, and it's not sensitive to normal feedback mechanisms. So you could say that some depressed individuals are in a state of increased stress, and it's hard to tell which is the hen and which is the egg, if it's the depression that causes the stress, or if it's a stress that causes the depression. But the link is strong, and this has been an active field of research for many years. Several compounds have been tested, but none has reached patients.
I recently stumbled upon something that could very well change your clinical workflow. I always thought having a medical scribe was only for busy ER doctors. Well, with the release of all the new AI tech, a company called Lindy developed an AI-based note-writing scribe app, and it works phenomenally well. You start your patient visit, press record, and it listens and transcribes and then outputs your note exactly how you want it. What I like the most about it is that you can customize exactly how you want your note to come out. And that's different from some of the other AI-based note writing apps out there. For example, if you want 5 sentences in your intro and you want to include quotes, psychotherapy themes discussed, it will do exactly that. Or if you simply want to dictate and use short phrases in your dictation, you can do that too. It can also give you follow-up instructions, referral letters, and consultation notes. Absolutely amazing. You can even use it for other AI-based tasks. It will save you so much time and make you more engaged with your patient's visit. Sign up now at lindy.ai/Bruce for a 7-day free trial with absolutely nothing to lose. And Lindy is giving listeners of this podcast 50% off their first month. That's lindy.ai/Bruce for 50% off your first month. Please go and check it out. I can guarantee you that you will be amazed at what you see. Now back to the episode. Is there a clinical correlate to somebody who has a dysfunction in their HPA axis? Like, is there a clinical picture that a clinician could be looking out for to decide, hey, I think there's maybe a dysfunction in this area that we need to test for to confirm?
I think originally there were ideas about that. There is one physiological test, a challenge test called the DEX-CRH test, which can identify individuals that are having hyperactivity of the HPA axis. And for some time, it was thought that it could be linked to certain clinical presentations, like melancholic depression, which is perhaps the most severe form of depression. But it has not really been possible to, over time, substantiate that relationship. So unfortunately, it is not as easy as we clinicians would like it to be to say that you have these symptoms and therefore you should have this medicine.
So say the HPA axis is dysfunctional or dysregulated in some way. What does the medicine do that you are describing or developing? And can you just put that in simplistic terms? Is it going to basically downregulate that axis?
Yes. So we actually have two different medicines in development, and they're both active on the HPA axis centrally. One is a blocker of vasopressin at the vasopressin V1B receptor, and the other one is a blocker of another hormone called CRH at the CRH1 receptor. And both these receptors are involved in the activity of the HPA axis. So by blocking these receptors, we have a tool to calm down this hyperactive system.
Gotcha. For the selection criteria for the patients who using to target this medication with, is it mainly treatment-resistant depression patients who have already failed other medications, and why is that?
Right now, we are actually aiming for a broader depressed population, major depressive disorder. It may be that practically that the medications will be more used for treatment-resistant depression, but the programs are being conducted in a broad, more general depressed population. We have another program that is focused more on the treatment-resistant depression.
And how have outcomes improved in your trials that you've done where you are taking this approach? Like, how much better is this approach than the conventional therapies?
I mean, that is what we currently are exploring. And to give an example from one of the leading programs we are having, where we are using a vasopressin V1B inhibitor, this is a compound that actually was in clinical development about 15 years ago with a large pharma company. It was explored both for depression and generalized anxiety disorder, which is a somewhat related condition. The company did 3 large studies, and in one of the depression studies, the compound demonstrated efficacy. It met the primary efficacy endpoint. So we know that the compound has antidepressant properties, but the efficacy was only on par with that of a standard antidepressant, and the compound was not developed further. We believe that the broad population was perhaps consisting of several subsets of patient groups, and that there was one patient group with the hyperactivity of the HPA axis that was driving the overall results. So our ambition is now to identify that subset of individuals and focus the treatment there. And in that population, we would then expect better efficacy than what you get with the standard antidepressant.
That's great. It sounds like you took those results and used them to your advantage, even though there was originally no differentiator from the original comparator. It seems like you used that to do the next phase of the study.
Yep.
And why the focus in your company on treatment-resistant depression?
For treatment-resistant depression, we are developing another compound, ketamine, which is already to some extent used clinically. And there is also a version of ketamine with the S-enantiomer that is approved as a nasal spray for depression. So this is a very well-established treatment for depression today, even though ketamine started its life as a powerful anesthetic. The drawback with ketamine-based compounds so far has been that efficacy seems to come together with certain characteristic side effects. The most well-known, I think, is a dissociative experience, which is an almost out-of-body experience with almost psychotic characteristics, which many persons experience as unpleasant. And during that period, you can also perhaps do things that are dangerous. So for that reason, these kinds of treatments are currently given under medical supervision. And for the approved nasal spray, you shouldn't drive a car until the following day. So even though the medication is powerful, robust efficacy, early onset of effect, the uptake has been a bit limited because of these concerns. So what we are doing here is that we are developing a novel formulation of ketamine. It's a tablet, an oral formulation, but with a very slow release. And the slow release leads to the peak concentration of the active parent substance, ketamine, becomes much lower than what we get, for instance, with intravenous treatment. And since ketamine acts on the NMDA receptor and causes these unwanted side effects, we are thereby able to drastically reduce the incidence of dissociation and also blood pressure increase and sedation. We have found a way to come around the negative effects of ketamine, but we have been able to retain the antidepressant efficacy because we had a phase 2 study reading out last year where we could see a very rapid onset of effect, reaching statistical significance within 4 days, this benefit without these side effects. And we think this has to do with the fact that when ketamine is metabolized, it generates downstream metabolites, norketamine and hydroxynorketamine. And these compounds have been implicated as being antidepressant. So our hypothesis is that the ketamine antidepressant efficacy may, to a large extent, be driven by the metabolites, as we can see an effect in the clinical trials. And the very low concentration of ketamine is beneficial because it does not elicit these dissociative side effects. So it seems as if we've been able to find a better balance between benefit and risk with our formulation than what has been possible with the other formulations.
Would it be taken on a daily basis for an extended period of time like we think of typical antidepressants are taken, or would it just be for a short burst of 5 days or so?
In our program so far, we have used daily dosing for up to 3 weeks, and the medication has been taken at home as well, without supervision, without any problems being reported. We believe that going forward, we could go down to a less frequent dosing. So for instance, the approved nasal spray is given no more often than 2 times per week, and over time, even less frequently. We believe that intermittent dosing perhaps is the best approach going forward.
This episode is brought to you by Charm Health. If you're in the market for a secure, stable, easy-to-use EHR system, this is the place for you. I've been using Charm for over 5 years, and I've found it to be the one EHR system that I've used where I'm spending more time thinking about my patients and less time thinking about charting. It just makes everything so easy. It has everything in one spot, and their pricing is extremely transparent, unlike many other EHR systems. Every feature that you want in an EHR, Charm has, from dot phrases to e-prescribing to document management, scheduling, and billing all in one. I've studied EHR usability and also did a podcast episode on EHRs, and I can safely say that Charm is among the top in clinician satisfaction. Not to mention, they are always releasing new features, and not just to stay abreast on the current market, but user-requested features as well. They are extremely open to feedback and improving, and I've gotten to know many of them at the Charmalot conference, which was a blast. I highly recommend Charm, and I think they have a phenomenal EHR system. Reach out to me or to someone on the sales team to schedule a demo, or visit charmhealth.com for more details. So this is only for people who have failed other medications. And why is that? Why use it for those individuals rather than somebody who has their first episode of depression?
I think it's a good question. I think we have chosen to start in the treatment-resistant depression territory, not the least because of the very high unmet medical need there. We have seen how use both of intravenous ketamine, which is then not FDA approved yet, and the approved nasal spray has really been useful in these populations. I also think that given the risk of dissociative experiences, previous developments have been aiming for a more severe, harder to treat part of the population where the risk of dissociation could be justified. But we believe that if we can really minimize this risk, it would probably be possible to consider and extend the development program in indications that go beyond TRD. But it's very important that this is in the form of a regular, formally correct FDA-approved development process. So we are starting now in the TRD end.
Let's switch gears a little bit to artificial intelligence. And in what ways is HMNC using AI?
We have been using AI to generate the companion diagnostic tests that identify the patients. Essentially, what we have done is to combine an approach where we have selected candidate genes. In one of the companion diagnostics, we have also used information from this physiological challenge test, the DexCRH test, and we have been feeding them into our system. And then we are using an AI approach to identify SNP combinations that signal a tendency to respond to these particular interventions. These calculations are so large and so complex that they cannot really be done in any other way except by using an AI approach.
And what does that tell you when you apply AI to that data set? Like which SNPs are more targetable?
It's a combination of understanding SNPs that could be sitting in candidate genes that are of interest, but it's also an agnostic approach where the system also finds additional SNPs that could be informative and tries to build an algorithm that tells us which SNP combinations are most likely to predict response to a certain intervention.
So we talked about a number of different programs that HMNC is working on. Which are the closest to market and which are you most excited about?
I think I'm pretty excited about them all. I think the companion diagnostic guided programs are in a way very novel and to some extent our flagship programs because it's a really boots on the ground attempt to include companion diagnostic in the selection of a novel treatment. But the most advanced program in terms of time to the market is our ketamine program, the prolonged release oral ketamine that we are developing in a joint venture with a Swiss company. Here we are now have completed two phase two trials and we are ready to step into the later development phases for the vasopressin V1B blocker. We are currently undertaking a large phase two trial in 8 countries in Europe that is almost halfway through. So that this is a trial that will test both the compound, the vasopressin blocker and the prototype companion diagnostic. And then we are aiming at entering phase two with the CRH1 receptor blocker later this year. So they are slightly staggered, but they all are well on their way into the later development phases.
If a clinician who is listening is interested in these opportunities or wanting to follow along or get more involved, what might they do to do so?
I would suggest try to follow what we are doing. We are right now planning for future clinical trials in all our three programs. And depending on where these trials will be conducted, there may be an opportunity for investigators and patients, of course, to participate in trials. But that is something that still is a bit in the future because we already have studies ongoing. But when there will be new studies coming out, there may be possibilities.
Awesome. What challenges do you foresee in the future other than the typical ones related to funding and enrollment and things of that nature?
I think for the companion diagnostic guided programs, I think it's about changing the mindset. We as psychiatrists are not used to using tools to be guided about what treatment could be the best. It is to some extent changed the way the considerations before start of a treatment are made. At what point in time should the patient be tested? You could say that it's obvious that the earlier you test, the earlier the patient has a possibility to get the right medication. But also, how do you convince a clinician who is used to start his standard and depressed patient, if you use that term, on an initial course with sertraline or escitalopram or some of the other commonly used first-time treatments?
Mm-hmm. One way I think we can maybe change that mindset is to explain or let it be known that it would save time and money and a lot of suffering in order to do a test earlier on.
And we also expect that if our hypothesis hold water, which we hope and think they do, then the expected improvement in the selected population will be better than if you just applied a standard antidepressant on the full population. So I think this gives us an opportunity to push the treatment outcomes and the treatment expectations some steps forward.
That's very cool. I think HMNC is up to a lot of very interesting projects, and I fully expect to hear more down the road after you get through these trials. thank you so much for your time and insights and all the hard work that you're doing in this to try to help a lot of people down the road.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
That's it for this episode. I'd appreciate it if you please like and share this podcast with your colleagues. It'd be especially helpful for us. If you'd like, please leave us a rating on your favorite podcatcher. If you're a clinician, I developed a course on how to start a private practice. And for patients, I've also developed a course on acceptance and commitment therapy and cognitive behavioral based therapy lessons for treating and helping anxiety. You can find all these on our website as well as the show notes and resources for each episode. Thank you so much, and I'll see you in the next episode.